Hello and welcome to the Hall of Fame Video Game Podcast, starring Matt Levy and Mike Staub. We love video games and have embarked on a journey to index the greatest video games of all time into our very own Hall of Fame. Here's the show. And hello there, Mike. How are you, sir?
Hey, Matt. How you doing?
Doing bloody well. Bloody well, thank you.
Yeah, me too, or whatever.
Well, we all know what bloody hell and bloody well mean.
Yes. Chicken chaser, yes.
Chicken chaser, indeed. So, Mike, I launched us today with a terrible English accent because we're going down a rabbit hole that is Fable, a game that we've talked about its previous title previously, and here we're talking about the sequel, Fable 2, 2008, in October. It was a fall release. What do you remember about this game, and what do you remember about it following the original?
You know, the original had this almost impossible marketing campaign to live up to. Peter Molyneux, for all intents and purposes,
Lionhead Studios,
he kind of does this thing where he comes out and says something along the lines of, this is going to be the most epic game you've ever played. And the first game comes out and it's solid. Is it the best game ever? No, but it's really solid. It's a solid 20-hour action RPG, which I think is a good thing. Or I think the first one's probably a little shorter.
Yeah, it's a little more linear, obviously, than he promised.
Yeah.
And it's on the original Xbox compared to this one, which is on the HD console.
Yeah, so that's the original Xbox. That was 2004, so that was getting towards the end of the Xbox life. So we're a few years into the Xbox 360 cycle, and Fable 2 is set to come out from Lionhead Studios. And I remember that it was like, the marketing was almost like, it's like Fable, but better. And the game plays a lot like the original, but I do believe that it's more expansive. It has more open zones. It has less linearity. The decision-making process is still part of it, the good versus bad. But you get some extra things. You get a dog companion. You gain access to firearms just to represent that the storyline in Fable 2 has progressed away from the first Fable. And at the end of the first Fable, you beat the Jack of Blades or whatever his name is. You beat Jack of Blades, and then the world of Albion, which is kind of the fictionalized version of the greater United Kingdom, kind of writes the heroes off as though they're corrupt and bad. So heroes kind of go away and go into hiding. And this game takes place 500 years later. So we could assume that in the game, if we were to compare it to like the real world, we're getting into more of like the early modern period. And Fable 2 definitely feels like it's more in the realm of like post-Renaissance, maybe a little Victorian era, a little steampunk era, feels a little colonial.
Colonial, yeah.
Like something about Fable 2 feels like, yes, it takes place in Albion, which is supposed to be England, but it also could very well could have taken place in kind of the land around Plymouth Rock, right? And kind of like the Massachusetts colony. So it does have that feeling, very much like the feeling you get when you read Neil Gaiman's 1602, which is a Marvel Comics alternate universe that takes place in the year 1602 in the old world. And Fable 2 feels like it's right on the cusp of that. And the way they were able to develop and design this game by giving the character a little bit more freedom in terms of what they could do and where they could go. This game kind of builds on the original and makes it a much, I think, more complete experience. I think a much more appealing experience. You still have that wonderful kind of goofy English humor and the goofy character designs. But ultimately, in the end, Fable 2, I think, is the strongest of the games in the series. I think it's better than Fable 3, which gets a little too into kind of like the simminess of it all. And it's more robust than Fable 1 by offering you a lot more systems and a lot more kind of things to do, right, in this game. Like, you really are building a life for your character in Fable 2, which is what the first game really promised.
Yeah, I think the key word you said there a few times is a more complete, more robust game, more things to do. Those are the key words that I pulled from there, Mike. And you started with the create a character. In the original game, the decisions you make put a halo on your head, you get some devil horns. But for the most part, you're doing very little to customize the visual aspects of your character. Just the visual aspects in this alone, you can get a lot more clothing items, hairstyles, tattoos, makeups, just starting with the character alone. Before we get into anything else, that's a lot more robust.
Yeah, that the character creator and the character designer in this game kind of took everything that worked from the first game and made it even better. And I felt like the looks of your character in this game are way more unique than they were in the first. I think the first game, your character kind of ends up looking the same regardless of the playthrough. This game, I think you can get a little bit more customizable with it. And I think that really makes for what this game is trying to do. The code word for Fable originally, I believe, was Project Ego. And that's kind of what it's about, right? It's about creating this character that exists within this world.
Yeah, and what you can actually visually change the size of your character. I love this, and that based on your diet or some of the decisions within the game, your character will be slim, or if you eat a lot of meat, so they kind of are punishing carnivores, but you eat a lot of fruits and vegetables and you become very thin, while alcohol, meat, and pies make you this big, obese-looking character.
Yeah, I feel like that doesn't exist if Grand Theft Auto San Andreas doesn't come out. Like, I feel like that's a big influence on pretty much all
of contemporary
games like that.
But we've talked about, when we played San Andreas, when we talked about that game, we talked about how role-playing was such a huge aspect of that. And this is a role-playing game. I mean, people say, well, it's really an action game. Well, no, these type of decisions make it feel more like a role-playing game.
Yeah, I mean, it's an action RPG. It's definitely more of an RPG if you're looking at customization than a lot of role-playing games that had come out at the same time. It seems like Western RPGs tend to get really into the weeds when it comes to character customizations, whereas Japanese role-playing games, you're kind of playing a set character before we get into like the Dark Souls games and the MMOs that they've made and like Monster Hunter. But at this point in time, 2008, we're still talking about Final Fantasies and Dragon Quest and games like that, Tales games, where you've got set characters and the role-playing is in the stats and the leveling and the improvement. Whereas the Western games, the role-playing is really in the version of the character you want to build, whether you're playing Oblivion at this point in time, Fable 2, games like Mass Effect.
Yep.
Dragon Age, like those are all games where you're really crafting a character, whereas the Japanese role-playing games are more about making your way through the story and they're not as open in terms of character stuff. So that's always kind of the difference. And also I feel like Western RPGs, you're pretty much primarily playing as just the one character.
Yeah.
Where Japanese role-playing games, you usually have a team or a party of some sort. But this is just an action RPG. It's a solid standard action RPG. The combat is simple. It's easy to grasp. They add the gun in this game where you get a gun that you can use, which I think is always really cool.
And yeah, adding firearms does change the gameplay up a lot.
Oh, quite a bit. It makes it interesting, in my opinion.
Especially in a fantasy type game, it is interesting because you got magic and you have sword play, which swords are magical in this world too. Also, not just the Western versus Japanese type of role-playing game, just comparing Fable 1 to Fable 2, I feel like this game has more role-playing in the fact that you can have a family, you can have property, you can make a business, you can become mayor or a king. Those are things in Fable 1, it was kind of a linear story. This is, you can kind of take the story in a few different ways.
Yeah, this game is cool with the inclusion of the ability to buy property. I think like every property in the game is available to purchase except for, I think, the Spire? You can't buy the Spire, right?
Yep.
So everything is there. You can buy shops. You can make money. You can use some sort of glitch or some sort of whatever to also game the system and earn a lot of money.
Yeah, there were a lot of tricks at that time to try and earn money fast.
Yeah, it's mostly just adjusting the clock.
You become
the
a little
console.
More evil, I think, if you charge more rent and charge more money for places.
But if you want to cheat the system, you just Change the clock on your
360. I think every 5 minutes your properties earn money. So yes, even while the game is off,
you're
earning money. So it is really cool, that time system, which you didn't see a ton of at that time. This was still an early concept.
Yeah, you're seeing more and more here of that. And while the story of Fable 2 doesn't really give us anything super special, that's kind of not the point of these games.
Yeah.
Right? Fable, the reason why it's called, has such a generic title, such as Fable, is because it's just a story. It's a classic, basic story that you're making your way through. So you start out as a kid in Bowerstone, and your dream is to live in the big castle, and you kind of grow up and go about living your story, which is great. It's great fun. And because it's not super strict on story and doesn't beat you over the head with too much story development, makes the game a little bit more, like we've been saying, customizable to your experience.
Yeah, I definitely think the journey and what decisions you make are more important than the story. I think that's a big part of what makes this game special. And I don't know about you, but sometimes going from 4x3, 480p, which the Xbox was, and moving to the HD era, it could be clunky for a lot of developers. If you look back at the original Xbox version of Fable, it's not a pretty looking game. It was doing a lot with early 3D. This game is how I think we all remember the original Fable actually looking, and now in widescreen. I think with Fable Lost Chapters, which was the kind of the remastered version of the original Fable that added a little bit more on the PC and the later consoles, so I think 360. But this game, I happen to think, looks really magical. It's got a really nice aesthetic and a little bit, the art style is almost a little cartoony, Mike, would you say?
Yeah. Yeah.
No, it's not going for realism, the art style.
No, not in general. And I like that. I like that this series has a style, and I like that it's stylized. Realistic stuff decays really quickly.
Yeah.
We even see that with pretty much every video game series on the planet. Every time a game goes for like realism, you look back 5-10 years later and it doesn't look as good. The games that are stylized, that have this kind of more artistic approach to what the game should look like, ultimately those games end up looking better over time, for sure.
Yeah, no, I do agree with that. Now, you said something earlier that is kind of a natural evolution of a lot of sequels, is this is larger, more open areas. Mm-hmm. The game is larger in general. And the first game, you go back to it, it's a lot of linear areas, a lot of loading.
Yeah, a ton of loading.
I love the original Fable, but you go from screen to screen. Within 2 minutes, you can go to 3 or 4 different loading screens. This had more open to explore.
Yeah, it was definitely a little bit more open to the player.
Yeah.
And that's important. It's important for the player to be able to experience this world and go through it. And you still have your morality system and you have all the other things you can do. And what's great about it is you don't have to do all those things, right? Right. You don't have to buy every property. You don't have to buy every shop. You can go about the game the way you want to go about it and play your quests and your side quests and just kind of make your way through the story. And it's a good time. It's a really fun game. And it's got just very kind of simple, strong gameplay elements, right? It's not trying to break the mold. It's just trying to give, at this point in time, Xbox 360 players just a solid RPG experience that's a little different than some of the other stuff. It is contemporary with games like Fallout 3.
Mm-hmm.
And Elder Scrolls 4 Oblivion, that are these giant kind of unending experiences. Even though Fallout 3 is not that long, it can be kind of made long.
This always seemed a little more approachable and accessible and even easy for a skill level than those.
Well, also, like, these games, the Fable games, aren't PC minded first, right? The first person RPGs that you would get from Bethesda, well, yes, they are very much at home on the Xbox 360. I think that's actually always been the best place to play these games, and I don't think they've been able to kind of get back to that quality ever since. Skyrim is really good, but once again, we're just playing an Xbox 360 game that looks better. I feel like Fable is more inviting, and it's a game that is built console-minded first because it's an action game that requires a use of a controller. Like, I couldn't see myself playing this with keyboard mouse.
Yeah, no, I think gameplay accessibility and controlling it, you can be turned off by certain gameplay. We were talking briefly about Baldur's Gate, and there's some games just feel more at home in certain control styles. So I think this is definitely one of them that just fits nice on the 360.
Yeah, I mean, Baldur's Gate is coming out for PS5. I have no idea how it's going to work on PS5. It definitely just seems like you need all of the tools that you have at hand on the computer keyboard to be able to play. And I feel like playing Fable 2 on a PC seems like a very difficult way to approach it, because
there are definitely genres like DC Online, same thing, where it's like they brought it to console, but it did ever feel right on a console. And it's the same thing as Baldur's Gate, right?
No. I mean, it's just, I feel like some of these games, you need a controller. Some of these games, you need keyboard mouse. And I think they're completely different play styles.
Trying to put a square in a circle peg hole, right?
Yes, trying to put the square peg in a round hole, which apparently doesn't work very well.
Apparently doesn't work. Mike, you brought something up in your early introduction, and it's something that I think deserves a lot of credit. And it was your companion in this game, the dog.
Yeah,
and
the dog.
This was something, was this sort of fresh and unique? I mean, I know he talked about it for the first game and never made it into the game, and here it is in the second. I would think this was pretty memorable.
I thought so. I thought it was a pretty novel experience to have a companion like the dog with you. It also works with the art style, right? It also works with the feeling and the vibe. You kind of have this, it's Albion, but you have this kind of hunting in the wilderness of kind of like Massachusetts feel, where having a dog just makes sense, right? It makes sense to the entirety of the whole world. And it also plays into the comedy, right? And the humor of this series. And this series has a history of being rather humorous. So yeah, I think I'm up there. I'm right with you. I think the dog is a great addition. And I think if you put it in the first one, there might have been some problems with the game running on the original Xbox, like having all this stuff kind of work together.
No, you're not right about that. These games, they run pretty well. And you think if they threw too much in there, they might not have performed as they did. A couple other things I just want to throw out before we kind of close out this classic title, Mike, is this game had was called like a sparkle type trail when you're going through your missions. And this is something that's not unique to Fable 2. I recently played Xenoblade Chronicles, the original definitive edition. I've played through other video games there. You can mark a mission and it'll show you a trail of where to go. What are your feelings on this type of feature in a game?
It depends, right? I think that I prefer when the icon is like on your compass, as opposed to giving you a literal trail to follow. I feel like with Fable 2, one of my kind of criticisms of this game is that the trail of breadcrumbs, the breadcrumb trail that they call it, often makes it feel like you're playing the game on autopilot sometimes. And you're just like chasing down this golden trail to wherever you got to go, from point A to point B to point C to point D. And while I get it and it's good to navigate, ultimately, I think it would be better, as we've seen in open world games as they changed over the years, to kind of just be a mark on your compass that you can like follow. And granted, you are doing the same thing. I just feel like when you have the trail of breadcrumbs there, your mind and your eyes are drawn to just following the trail and not kind of going off trail and looking for other stuff like you would in a game like Tears of the Kingdom, right?
Yep.
So it's one of those things where I get it. It's really good and helpful for those who aren't like super well acquainted with kind of bigger open world RPGs. But at the same time, I think it's a hindrance to the game.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I think if you look at truly great games from the genre, games that are trying to ask you to explore more, you won't see this because it's going to detract from exploration.
Yeah.
And I think a game like this, maybe they should have had it as like an easy mode or an accessibility mode if someone wanted it. But I believe this is, I don't know if I forgot, don't quote me. Do you know if this was an on or off feature, or was this just standard when you clicked on to the next mission?
I don't remember off the top of my head, but I remember being frustrated that you couldn't get rid of it. And there was no like map marker or compass marker, and you just had to follow the trail of breadcrumbs. And that was one of the things that frustrated me about it, only because it fed into my anxiety as a gamer, that I'm like, oh, I just need to keep following the line. And if I go off the path, I feel like I'm doing something wrong. I think games now have done a much better job of doing that. And it's not something that's just always on.
Yeah, no, I tend to agree with getting the most out of gameplay. This does detract, I think. Another thing this game did, the first game didn't, was added cooperative play. Now,
yeah, man,
it wasn't a perfect feature, but do you recall how co-op functioned in Fable 2? Or did you use it at all?
Yeah, I don't really remember using it personally, but I do remember them having like a henchman type situation where you would have the henchman kind of joining up with you and help you on missions. It's not a perfect solution. And you know what? Co-op in a lot of games is very difficult, whether it's like Mario Odyssey where you're the hat, you know, or something like this. I appreciated it, but ultimately in the end, this game feels like a single player experience and it doesn't feel like something that should be played with multiple players.
Yeah, some people were disappointed because if you did play online, you would join someone's hosted game and you would get the stats from your hero, but you would not get the look and abilities of your created character. So you were not getting the full experience on someone else's game, but it's nice that it was even there as a feature. I think it was a nice thing to offer, but yes, on the same console, someone's just a henchman and they can help their buddy on their mission.
Yeah.
But this game is really about, I feel like, your character and the dog and whatever family and journey you go on. Everything else is sort of just gravy.
Like I said, these are single player games. The fact that they added that as a little bonus is nice, but ultimately in the end, these are single player games. But I also want to say too, before we go further, games like these offer a lot more than just the story and buying stuff. You have the pub games that they spun out into its own release, which I thought was pretty cool. And whether you're playing some of the card games or like their roulette stuff or like their gambling games, I think that's cool. And I like when games add this, even though I don't always engage with them in a game. Like when I played The Witcher 3, I didn't sit around and play Gwent. I didn't do too much dart stuff in Final Fantasy VII Remake. I did do the pull-ups and the push-ups and the squats and all that stuff. But ultimately, this gives something to other people. Like I know people that have spent hours in Red Dead Redemption 2 just playing poker. Which is, in my point of view, is stupid, but I'm glad that they have that for people. Like
the you Final can spend, Fantasy VIII card game is like,
yeah, man,
it's a whole game in a game.
Listen, man, if you're not playing, why can't I think of the name of the game right now in Final Fantasy VIII? I keep thinking Tetramaster, which is the Final Fantasy IX, the Final Fantasy IX card game, but the card game in Final Fantasy VIII actually
triple triad.
That's it, triple triad. Triple triad's actually essential.
Yeah, it is.
You kind of need to play Triple Triad so that you can get the cards that you could turn into abilities and whatever and break your party. So yeah, you kind of need that Final Fantasy VIII, but a lot of other games, you don't need to sit down and play poker.
It makes the world, whether you engage with it or not, it makes it feel more realized, more real, fully breathing if all this extra stuff is there. And we'll talk to in the end what games we've been playing, but some of the recent games we've been playing had a lot of extra stuff I could do, whether I chose to engage with it or not. It's nice having it there. So
yeah, no, absolutely. It's good to have so that we can kind of further grow the experience and give
you could spend more time with your character.
Yeah, make people feel more connected and all that.
Last thing, Mike, before we close out is this game pretty famously had some DLC content, and this was still the time where people got a little upset because the DLC would come out only a few months after the game was released. They felt like, well, if this was already done, why not include it with the original game? And DLC we see now is more season pass and more content you get 6 months, a year, or sometimes 2 years later because it takes time to make the stuff. They're just trying to get the original game out the door. We know how hard AAA game development is, but this game, you got the first one, Not Whole Island, was released January 2009. This is only 3 months after the game came out. And then you got the second one, which is See the Future, in May of 2009. And again, another 4 months later. And then that, I believe a few months later, that September or so, you got the Game of the Year, which had all of it on one disc, not even a year later. So what is your thoughts on the DLC and the way that this was done?
I mean, that's kind of how things are done now, right? Stuff that's clearly left off on purpose so that they can make some extra money on it later. We've talked about AAA development and how difficult it is. And while this game released essentially 15 years ago, it was starting up then. That was kind of the beginning of how DLC could be kind of predatory.
Yeah.
In a way. So yeah, it's kind of like that.
I mean, sometimes, Mike, it was even on the disc when they shipped it, and then and then you'd pay for it and just unlock it. You didn't have to download anything.
I mean, famously, Marvel vs. Capcom 3, the Jill Valentine and Shuma Gorath characters were on the disc. You just pay to unlock it, which I think upsets people the most.
Yeah.
You know, DLC done right is usually done by companies at the time, like Bethesda. Obviously, yes, the horse armor was an absolute total joke. But when you're talking about adding like Knights of the Nine, the Shimmering Isles, those things, like those are almost full experiences. Witcher 3 also has that with whatever the two DLC packages are. I know there's like Blood and Wine is really popular.
Yep.
Which adds like almost to the point where like the DLC are games unto themselves. Pokemon Sword and Shield had really, really great DLC that felt like they were their own games. So there's a way to do DLC and there's a way to not do DLC. The DLC of this game was good.
It was.
In my opinion, I remember liking it, but it does feel like this stuff was purposely held back in order to generate more revenue later because the games are too expensive to make and just release without the promise of DLC.
No, I get that.
Which is confusing when you're looking at games like Baldur's Gate, and Baldur's Gate 3 rather, and Final Fantasy 16, who were out of the gate, they were like, we're not going to put DLC out. And it's like, oh, you spent all this money on this DLC.
I know. And sometimes, where we're hypocrites, because games like Elden Ring, people are like, where's the DLC? Where's the content? And then Animal Crossing took a really long time for that. And then you have Mario Odyssey that never got anything. And people kept saying, where's my extra content? So it's like a double-edged sword. We don't get it. We're angry as customers, but when we get it, we're like, how come I have to pay more for more content?
Listen, I don't want to completely trash our whole fan base or the whole fan base of gaming, but we're a bunch of spoiled babies. And all we want to do is complain about the stuff we either have or don't have. And we spend so much time complaining and being hypocritical. Now, granted, there are real honest arguments in there. Like on disc DLC is predatory. That should be not allowed and not explored. Just paying $10 when the game comes out, paying an extra $10 or $15 just to unlock two characters, like that's really bad. But having a game just end is also kind of scary if you're a company that it's not a game of service, right? It's not a game that's going to generate revenue every month. So you kind of need to make up your dev costs. So the DLC really can help that. And also at the same time, it's nice to sit down and revisit a game a year later. So it's hard. I think, I don't think there's any, I don't like to make a mass generalization about how DLC needs to be handled and whether or not it's good or bad. But I think in this instance, I think the DLC is solid. It would have been nice to have some of that content upon release, but you know what? They got to make their money too.
Well, I think there's a lot of game here just without the DLC, and it's there, yes, if you want it. So I think it's nice to have it versus not have it. So this game, Mike, was very highly received by critics. Metacritic put this at 89 out of 100.
Not bad.
Most magazine publications had 9s, 10s, and A's for this game. So I'd say it reviewed just slightly higher than the original Fable. And it did a lot of things, like you said, that the original Fable aimed to be. And the sales proved it. This was the best-selling RPG on the Xbox 360. Now, you can argue, is this actually an RPG versus more of an action game? You can have that argument, but it sold almost 4 million copies by March of 2010. So you're talking about a game that sold, well, Xbox 360, we remember very fondly, but the hardware sales and software sales were actually not as high as we think. It was a well-received console, but it didn't sell gangbusters.
No, and also everyone was buying the Wii. So it's one of those things where it's like, oh, well, 360 did all right. I think it's probably Xbox's bestseller. It's probably the most popular Xbox system. But ultimately, in the end, it's hard to compete out there. I don't know if it did better than the PS3. I know PS3 had a really tough time at the start.
PS3 actually still ended up outselling it, even though
I think
that Xbox 360 won the generation. Fable 3 actually sold more units.
Yeah. PS3 just kind of, it's hard. You have the name. You have the namesake of PlayStation. People are looking for that.
But again, 4 million copies and an 89 score on Metacritic. These are really impressive. People do consider this an all-time game. People do consider this the memorable one of the trilogy, as you said.
It is definitely the best game in the trilogy. by far, I think. And while the original Fable was more of a proof of concept, this is the concept seen full fruition.
Yeah. And I'd say famously and most importantly, Mike, this is the only Fable game, very few video games besides it, where you can actually get an STD.
Yep. And hey, man. Hey, man, you're going to play that way? Let it happen.
You can get an STD. So that's up to the thing you can get from a Mario or Zelda game, guys. So just remember that.
Definitely not.
Definitely not. So that is Fable 2 from 2008, famously for the Xbox 360, the action RPG. Mike, we haven't done it in a while. Playing anything fun lately you could tell us about?
Yeah, I've been playing a little bit of Baldur's Gate 3, which I've really been enjoying. And I played a little bit of Pokemon Scarlet. I kind of went back and played a bit more of that and had some fun with it. The game's still a technical mess, but there's something just appealing about it. And I think Baldur's Gate 3 is a really solid D&D-based RPG. It's very much in the line of the old Baldur's Gate games, the Divinity games, and games like Knights of the Old Republic. It really feels like it's in that vein. A lot of people are kind of saying that Baldur's Gate 3 versus Zelda, which is the better game, which get Game of the Year. Baldur's Gate 3 is not doing anything hyper original in terms of gameplay. It's not breaking the mold. It's kind of giving us the best version of that type of game. Whereas Zelda completely changes everything. So it's hard. It's hard to judge them against each other because there's an argument that could be made for both. I still think Tears of the Kingdom is about a leap and bound better than Baldur's Gate 3, but Baldur's Gate 3 is definitely in the conversation for one of the best games of the year. It's just the production value alone is so incredibly good. And the ability to bring a Dungeons and Dragons feel to a video game is amazing, especially when you actually do the dice rolls, when you have skill checks and stuff like that. It's very cool. It's very, very cool. They found, like when you're in a conversation and you need to use one of your D&D skills, actually roll a virtual D20, which I think adds additional tension to the situation and also makes everything feel that much more rewarding when you succeed and that much more terrible when you fail. So the game knows what it's doing. It knows what makes D&D so good, and it has incredible characters, voice acting, amazing graphics, great music. Like, it is a full, complete package. It is difficult. It is difficult. The game throws a lot at you as a player, and it's hard to progress forward. But it's a really, really solid game, and definitely a game that if I do a Game of the Year list at the end of the year, I haven't played as many games this year as I normally do. If I do a Game of the Year list at the end of this year, it's definitely a game that I'd be interested in putting towards the top.
Yeah, I think it's going to be an interesting conversation. I love that there is competition for Zelda because it seemed like the runaway favorite, even with some other great titles this year. But I think two things going against Zelda is A, timing. That was earlier in the year. People think, what have you done for me lately? And this game is the hot topic right now. And then two, it was on a Nintendo console, which some people will knock it for being on a, what are we, seven years now old console, while Baldur's Gate is going to be on PS5. It's on the PC. So I think it's in potentially more hands. I don't know.
No, I don't think so. I don't think, I think
there's more Switches in the wild than PCs and PS5s.
No, but I think that this game is inherently prohibitive to players. I think this is a heavy game.
Okay.
That has, but you know what? I could be wrong. The sales for Baldur's Gate 3 could be, they could have sold 30 million already.
So you think it's a louder minority of this genre type game?
I don't know. I don't know. I could be 100% wrong. I don't know the sales figures.
I know it set Steam records, but that's, I think it was 800,000. Still, I think there's been 20 million copies of Tears of the Kingdom sold. So it still might be potatoes, small potatoes.
I mean, I think Baldur's Gate 3 is sold somewhere around 5 million copies at this point, which is really, really good.
Really good for a game like that.
And that's pretty good. That's really good. And it'll sell really well on PlayStation 5. Zelda's probably going to sell about 25 to 30 million copies. Baldur's Gate might get there.
Yeah.
Might get there. But Switch is also the best-selling console after the PS2. I think it just surpassed the Wii.
I think it's a million copies from PS2, which is just something crazy.
I think it just surpassed the Wii, which is huge. So I don't know. I don't know. I don't think it being on the Switch is a deterrent to Zelda. I think if you're judging a game based on what a game does, and a game is supposed to just be a good game, I think Zelda, there will be plenty of publications that give Baldur's Gate 3 Game of the Year. But I also think there will be plenty of publications that give Zelda game of the year as more people start playing it again as the year gets closer to the end. And Baldur's Gate 3, yes, it was the hot topic for a few weeks, but now Armored Core is the hot topic for now. So,
and then by the next time this airs, people are talking about Starfield. So I think it's going to quickly switch.
It's going to be Starfield, which I think is going to be a technical mess and virtually unplayable for a few months.
Spider-Man 2. It's going to be just, and then Mario Wonder. It's every week there's going to be a new topic, I feel like.
Yep, up until December, I think every few weeks we're going to have a new hot game. So right now it seems like, it's Armored Core, then it'll be Starfield, then it'll be Mario Wonder, then it'll be Spider-Man, then it'll be whatever else for the end of the year. So we got a lot of
it should be fun to monitor all of this. So thank you, Mike, for sharing what you've been playing lately.
Thanks, Matt.
I'm also playing some Pokemon. I agree with you. There's a fun game underneath this absolutely technical mess. The performance is atrocious, but it's actually, if you get past all that, it's quite a good video game. And that's what I just completed this week. And hopefully in a few weeks or next month, we will return to what we've been playing lately. But until then, Mike, I want to hear, where can people find you on the internet?
You can find me here on the Hall of Fame Video Game Podcast on pretty much every episode. And you can also find me on with my other podcast with Batman Tastacash. You can search us out at Batman Tastacash. You can find me with my band, Bad Mary. You can search us out, Bad Mary Band, on all social media or badmary.com. And then you can find me at Long Island Retro Gaming. Even though the expo is over for the year, there is still lots of stuff, good stuff going on all the Long Island Retro Gaming channels. So give them a search.
Awesome stuff. Please do check our back catalog. Please do leave us a review and tune in next time. Me and Mike have some awesome more games we plan to talk about.
Absolutely. I'm very excited. I love it.
Guys, enjoy the end of summer. We'll see you next time.
Thanks.
From Mike and Matt, thank you for listening to the Hall of Fame Game Podcast. Check us out on Instagram at Hall of Fame Pod or email us at thehalloffamepod@gmail.com. Please leave us a review and be sure to tune in next time.